I thought maybe I could read and talk about the chapter It's called The Active Participation in Loss. So this is not a very favorable chapter. And I think maybe one of the things why Zen survived through all its persecution in China, etc., was because it knows how to deal with loss. And as human beings, I think, first of all, the reason why we come here is because we know already of impermanency. Nothing is permanent. And of course, this leads into the three marks of existence. If nothing is permanent, then there's no self. There's no you. But I mean, just because there's no you doesn't mean there's you will disappear, but there's a greater self. So everything's impermanent, so there's no permanent self, so there's no self. It's a natural gradation. And then when there's no self, there's nirvana, or there's your realization of your basic goodness. And so impermanency, because things are always changing, everything is changing, even the sun. All conditions change. Even the sun will perish. And there's nothing we can do about it. Because it was created. So,
when I first heard these teachings,
this loss is in tune with something that's non-dwelling. Something that's, something that has no origin. Something that's non-dwelling, and something that is doesn't go anywhere. Those three is the investigation. What is has no origin. What does not stay at one place? What is not located? And where does it go? Those are the three most important things. So in order to do that, you are already inspired to look for some other alternative. And it's not, it is an alternative, and a great alternative. It's not a step down. It's not even a step up. It's just a step where you are. Right where you are, because it doesn't exist outside yourself. So this is how this chapter came about. And we're all faced with loss. And it's beyond whether we like it or not. In the late Uchiyama Roshi's book, Opening the Hand of Thought, so it's a kind of metaphor he used, that our fists are always closed. But when you let go and open it or relax it, there's a different being that exists. When you eat, when you sleep, when you're sitting down, when you're using a computer, notice your hand. Be aware of your hand. What's it doing? So it's opening the hand of thought. So when you can. By opening, you can let the world in. I even do this for myself sometimes. Oh, open, you know? So it's not just this hand, but it's the whole body and mind. So Uchiyama Roshi, he came from a very difficult background. Usually Roshis have very difficult lives. And he was married twice, and at the same time both wives died. So that's the sense of loss led him to become this great Roshi that I talked about earlier. And when I met him, usually you're supposed to ask some kind of a Zen question, right? I looked into his eyes and they were just glowing like stars. So, and the Ba that you return is like the first time. Can you remember when you bowed? It wasn't even in religion. And that we call religion, but I can remember. There were many times you bow before the gesture of the palms coming together. Well, I think when I was a young man, I bought this bow and arrow. It was a Taiwanese bow and arrow from Cost Plus. And Aborigine, it had the sheath on the bow itself, and I used to like to shoot it because I was studying Zen. But in those days there weren't many Zen books, and so I would draw a circle, maybe a 10-12 foot circle, and find out the days that I was living in Palo Alto, find out the days that the elementary school wasn't in session, draw the circle, and I would shoot the arrow up. And it had an iron arrowhead. And what I liked about it was when I shot it up, I had to pay attention. And there was some point after the feather, and at some point it turns, and now it's coming down. And so it's a good exercise in awareness. And then you watch it as it comes down, and then you watch it fall on the ground. Then one time, I was in Auburn, and I brought my bow and arrow because I knew we were near a school, so I shot it on the football field, and it went further. It went further than the football field. It was just a short, very short arrow and a short bow, and then I realized, I bowed. You know, I don't know the form of bow. But the bow came from somewhere already. It's in you. It's not outside of you. It's just now that, you know, when people prize something, or it's a universal symbol. You put the left and the right together. You put the dualities together, and there's this joy and presence of what you're feeling, of what you're expressing, of what you're connected with. So when I met him, he offered me a cigarette. And I was smoking. I smoked many years, but now can't. And he smoked 6 cigarettes. He vowed after his wife died, he would just smoke 6 cigarettes for the rest of his life. And he does. He still does. Just 6. And then we both shared a cigarette. And he says, Now that I'm retired, I don't have to sit anymore. And he says, I walk down the river with my arms behind my back, and he looks at the sky, and he's so happy. No more pain. So he's over 50 years of sitting, so that's some instruction for us. As you engage in sitting, there's strong sitting and there's weak sitting. The weak sitting is that you're overcome by pain. You're overcome by distraction. And the strong sitting is that you still have pain. And actually it's good to have the pain because you're still connected to life. We're not perfected. There's no perfection, you know. We're still connected to the pain of life, to living. So, but when you're not overwhelmed by sitting, then you're not overwhelmed by the things in everyday life. See, that's the connection. Those things don't move you. You're of the world. You're in the world, but not of it. You can appreciate your new car, the smell, the high tech stuff. But you're not attached to it.
Well, most of the time we're really not.
You can enjoy material goods, but you're not attached to it.
What would it mean for us when you say, how are you?
So this phrase, opening the hand of thought, left a very deep impression on me. Because it points to something that's been part of my life for a very long time. This phrase, the active participation in loss. Usually, we want to avoid loss at all cost. We are conditioned to seek only gain, to be happy, or to try to satisfy all our desires. Even though we understand intellectually that loss is the very mud in our lives that the lotus needs in order to bloom. When it comes to our actual lives, most people still believe loss is the opposite of gain. But as you can continue your meditation practice, loss and gain are just two phenomena. For instance, when we're happy, we become attached to that happiness, and therefore we suffer because it won't last very long. It's a fact. So when we're happy, we're just happy. And when we're sad, we're just sad. When something, when a long piece of incense and a short piece of incense, which one would you take? Which is better, a long incense or a short incense? Short is short, long is long. Each thing, each dharma has its intrinsic value. When we recognize the universe in this way, that means we're also recognizing ourselves. So you understand what I'm trying to say? You step out of the condition.
I was both seeing the suffering and feeling.
We are actively participating in loss. Actively means that we are willing, we are committed, not giving up, and that we have the courage to die, the old self dying, and becoming alive. The word loss refers to death and all the things that we usually don't want to talk about. It also implies failure and impermanence. Death is the ultimate failure. you can look at it another way. It's the grace of life that we are to die. And that we can, like Suzuki Roshi said, that we can bow at that very moment to let go and to forgive, to surrender, and to go back, to return to where we came from. We know where we came from. All those things that we believe to be negative, despite the fact that they are actually serve as an impetus for the most of us to practice. Loss in life brings us to practice. Impermanence brings us to practice. These are the perfect antidotes of a self-centered gaining life. In fact, if we could have a very permanent or secure, guaranteed life, if that were all that possible, most people would not practice because they would feel there's no need to. Near the end of the fall in 1991, Tokubetsu Sesshin, led by Narazaki Roshi, at Tassajara Monastery. I twisted my ankle, and I had a bad ankle from a car accident. And what happened was that as this session ended, I went to say goodbye to the teachers as they were leaving for to catch their flight. And I, you know how when you walk, all of a sudden your foot goes under? It went under, and I felt the pain, but I kept walking. I didn't heed the pain. I kept walking, and I was waving goodbye to them because I didn't want them to miss their plane, and I was standing on my foot. Actually, I was waving goodbye to myself. And I had to hobble back, and I had hurt, my foot was big, it had swollen twice or three times its size. After the van was out of sight, I limped back to the cabin, and there I saw a very swollen foot. I walked around with a stick that evening. I was surprised by the amount of pain. It took me a long time to walk around my own bed, using my hands for support. For many nights, it was agony. It felt as if I was being pulled deep underwater. It turns out that the spraining and damaging of ligaments or tendons is worse than breaking a bone. And in the end, I had to use crutches for 4 months. Somebody told me it will take at least 4 or even 6 months. I said, no, it couldn't be that. But it did. So there were problems. For example, how would I come into the zendo? And once there, how would I sit? How would I offer incense and bow before the altar? How would I lead the service, greet my students and visitors? There were many things to consider due to this loss of ability to do things my usual way. Usually we want to look as if we're in control, but my form now had to include crutches. As I entered the zendo, the crutches creaked on the wooden floor. Also, I couldn't sit in full lotus as I always had done. I always used to sit in full lotus, but I can't anymore. So I don't make any judgment on people who don't. Also, one of my students loaned me a beach chair. And I put it on my mat. To tell you the truth, part of me was afraid that the Sotoshu headquarters would come in one day and say, "This is California Zen." I had to extend my right foot and learn how to sit again. Not as I wanted to sit, but as I had to sit. In other words, I had to do it with loss. Isn't this a wonderful metaphor for what happens in each of our lives? To my surprise, I found that you can actually practice shikantaza in a beach chair without sitting cross-legged. All my opinions about people sitting in chairs, half lotus or seiza, dissolved. It was as if a large window opened for me. When I began to practice Zen in 1960, there were a lot of interest in martial arts, kendo, swordsmanship. I remember reading about some techniques in swordsmanship. And in one book, it says the best way in combat is to come out, strike your opponent, and quickly get away. In other words, no complicated technique. I thought it sounded like Zen. At least this was my interpretation. Very simple and direct. Just run. But the most difficult part came where the book confirmed the fact that the combat was to end in a mutual slaying. Oh, it's right. I didn't like this. I wanted to have the gain of winning the contest and ending up alive, but every day within our lives, to know how to lose is to be alive. Accepting things as they are is a loss, is an emptying out. Being in the moment is a loss. We are losing every moment of our lives. What are we losing? We are losing our self-centeredness, our self-clinging, our ideas, our condition. We are also losing ourselves to the sound of the turkeys, to the sound and feeling of the zendo, to the heating system in this room. Day after day, night after night. And when we know how to do this, to really lose, then we know how to really be alive. We generally say that to have a good seat takes nearly 10 years. When you think about how long it takes a fruit tree to bloom and bear fruit, 10 years is not a very long time. But we shouldn't just understand this literally. 10 years could be right now. Or it could be actually 10 years. But generally, it does take us some time to cultivate this seat. As I mentioned, Sekitoki Sen, the stonehead Zen master, used to sit on a very large stone. On this stone is carved the Chinese characters that read Genzo in Japanese, meaning source of our ancestors. How do you understand this phrase, the source of our ancestors? Not just our ancestors, where did they come from? Our source. Of course, Sekitoki Sen is our ancestor, but at the same time, the ancestor and the source of the ancestor is none other than the essence of our own mind source. Do you understand this? We are the same as the undying person in the hermitage. This refers to a poem that he wrote, Grass Hut Hermitage. And the end of the saying, the end of the poem is about who is this undying person in the hermitage. And that's our source, our most intimate self, appearing in one unbroken moment, preciously, pervasively, quiet, calm, and forever bright. Do you know what you are doing when you are practicing? When this ancestor, your most intimate self, is practicing? You are practicing the active participation in loss. We have fear, denial, resistance, sleepiness, exhaustion, and pain. We have the whole spectrum of loss. There's no gain here. Suzuki Roshi used to mention gaining self. In this kind of situation, there's not much gain because you are participating with loss. That means that even though you are sitting quietly on the cushion, you are actively, energetically participating with the many things. You are actively participating with pain, changing to sensation, with noise changing to sound, with awareness of distraction or sleepiness, and on and on and on. because you can practice being with these things, little by little, you will not be bothered by these conditions. Awareness vanishes, dissolves delusion. Even the sound of crickets will harmonize with your mind. When you practice active participation in loss, you are reconditioning yourself to re-enter the unconditional world. Actually, this phrase comes from really saying, from a realized saying by Uchiyama Roshi's teacher, Kotosawaki Roshi, who said, gain is delusion, loss is enlightenment. In our contemporary language, we say, loss is where it's at. The first noble truth that Buddha realized is that life is suffering. Maybe like some of you, when I first read this a long time ago, I felt it had a very negative connotation. But it's about actively participating with suffering, actively accepting the inevitability of change, which is an undeniable condition in our lives. Things are neither fixed nor permanent, but are constantly changing from moment to moment. There's an old saying, you can't step into a river the same place twice. This was Heraclitus. Sounds like a Zen saying. I thought it was Zen saying. Turned out to be Heraclitus. We usually create our own universe. We believe that we can step into the same place twice because we try to solidify our changing world so that our conditioned self can feel a sense of security. Actually, the whole river is moving. The river of life. The entire environment, both river and shore, is changing as well. It's only the fabrication of our minds that we're actually stepping into the same spot twice. But the truth of impermanence is stronger than our mind fabrications can ever be. And as a result, there's plenty of suffering or loss that will appear when we ignore this fact. A few years ago, we received a wonderful gift at Sonoma Mountain. It was an 11-faced wooden sculpture of Kanan, Kanseon, or Shenreize, or Kuan Yin. She is the mother of all Buddhas because of her great mercy and compassion. If you go to Buddha's birthplace in Lumbini, Nepal, you will see a temple there built for Buddha's mother, who is Queen Maya. It is 2,569 years ago. King Ashoka also placed the pillar there, and amazingly, is still standing. I was very impressed with this monument. In our country, in America, there are not many buildings built for mothers. When you honor a shrine like this, the best thing to do is to sit zazen by turning your light inward. Traditionally, when people arrive at a stupa or a shrine, the first thing they do is to circumambulate this monument three times by just walking like we do Kinyan, reverently, without thinking, in a sunwise or clockwise direction. Afterwards, when you do sit in the way I describe, you're returning to the loss and silence, which after all are inseparable. Returning there just for a few minutes keeps not only the monument alive, but ourselves as well. This is what the monument, this is what the structure is all about. The large Kannan statue we have in the Zendo was donated by Lee Lozovic, who's the spiritual successor of an East Indian Baul tradition and the home community in Prescott, Arizona. Coincidentally, the late Maizumi Roshi had done a calligraphy for this statue when it was in their temple. He had written Enmei Juku Kanan Gyo, which means the 10-phrase Kanan Sutra for prolonging life. When our Sangha was invited to receive the statue, there was a dispute in our community. That's kind of interesting, huh? How much would it cost? How big was it? Where would we put it, and how would we get it here? I really didn't have any idea, but when I saw the picture, I realized its beauty. I forgot about the details, then I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. Auspiciously, the home community decided to transport it from Prescott to Sonoma Mountain. There was a drought that year, and it rained all the way from Prescott to Santa Rosa. Mr. Lee's daughter, Rami, who was just 2 years old, was very fond of this statue, which is about 14 feet high. And sent a card along with the statue so it wouldn't get lonely. Her father gave it to me. It was in an envelope, and she had scribbled on the card with a yellow crayon, addressing it to me. And then you open the card, and inside was a picture of an umbrella with rain. And she signed it with another great effort of scribbling. This is Rami. Auspiciously, it arrived December the evening of December the 8th. It's an auspicious coincidence. And we cleaned it and oiled her on the Zendo deck with the help of the moonlight. When we stood her up the next morning, it was December the 8th, Buddha's Enlightenment Day. Surprisingly, a plaque came with the statue that said it was dedicated in Japan on December the 8th, 1959. This almost marks the same time Suzuki Roshi came to America. As it turned out, the statue was 14 feet high, and it now seems as it has always been standing in our Zendo. One time, the coach of the LA Lakers, Phil Jackson, said, "Is there anyone taller than I am here?" I said, "Of course." He said, "Well, who is it?" "It's Kan Zeon. She's 14 feet tall." One of the most distinguishing features of the 11-phase Kanon is the crown. I was never explained why she wore this crown. The main face that you see represents our regular face, like so. Just as when you look in the mirror, it's our face, and at the same time, it's not your face. This is very much like Tozan Ryokai's enlightened poem, which he experienced crossing a stream. He saw his true reflection in the water, and in that moment, he realized that he was not just an object to be seen. On Kanon's crown, the first three faces are similar, calm and peaceful in appearance. So there's one, two, three. There's one. One, two, three. As you move sunwise around to the right of the crown, the faces become more and more ghastly, reflecting or agonizing states of suffering. Fear, anger, hopelessness. I find this interesting. It would be difficult for the first three faces on the statue to see the ones on the other side, and even more difficult for them to see the ones in the back. Just as it's difficult for us to see or really face these things within ourselves. But if you wear them as a crown, all faces become Buddha. This is the freedom.
In English, the word detachment implies a kind of withdrawal.
This is the liberation. All faces become Buddha. What's behind the fear? It's the thought. What's behind anger? It's the thought. What's behind thought? There's nothing there. And there's nothing there is filled with everything. Has the capacity, has the unconfined capacity to be filled. We could say that the fourth face represents anger and hate. With real practice, when you are actively participating in the loss, that these conditions demand your posture, your breath, your awareness, will gradually dissolve the solidity of these delusional faces. Because in the end, they are transparent. There is nothing behind them. We say, because you are not aware, it is not practice. And if it's not practice, it is not perfected. And if it's not perfected, the fact cannot be realized. It's like you start a job and you never finish it. The practice can never be realized if you don't finish it. Maybe it's better not to start. The fifth face expresses anxiety, frustration, and confusion. This is a lot of good news, isn't it? The sixth, you could say, is isolation and rejection. The seventh and eighth and ninth represent the most difficult situations we will inevitably face in our life. Everyone faces these. And we should know this truth, because we have a mind and we have a human body. Devastation, despair, and hopelessness is the last three. This does not seem to be good news. But because we are fortunate enough to have a Dharma practice, we aren't forced to drink, take drugs, or even commit suicide. When we meet these faces, Kanon wears all these faces on her crown. They are a fact of living. The truth is that as you go around Kanon's crown, you're actually getting closer to something wonderful. Even though your energy may feel low and you may not feel well, sometimes in these last phases, you look surprisingly good because something is actually happening in your life.
So you can think of investigation as the wisdom.
People say, do you have a new boyfriend? Or and my wife said one time, she looked so wonderful, and she said, I'm in love. And I said, with whom? With myself. And Mrs. Suzuki was a very wonderful person for Suzuki Roshi. I think it was his, it was his second wife. And he was a very traditional Zen master, very strict, before he came to America. And when he came to America, he was still, you know, because of the conditioning, still pretty traditional. And so he would sit down, and when you eat, just eat. And when you wash dishes, just wash dishes. And Mr. Suzuki says, why don't you stick around a little bit and talk to me? He says, Samu, eating is finished. And then he goes and does his work, right? And one day, she said, I have something, a big secret to tell you. And he said, what is it? He says, I have a boyfriend. And he says, no problem, just bring him over. She was wonderful that way. And one day, I think I was 25 or 26, I came to the Zen of the city. There's only like three people or two people sitting there. And he would look out the window, see if anybody's coming for the morning, said, or call us up. And she opened the door, and she said, Suzuki Roshi had just died. And I said, and she said, April Fool, American joke. But she was wonderful. She was a wonderful teacher for all of us. So as you go around Kanan's crown, she wears it as a crown. It's a crown. It's our crown, not just hers. And we are getting closer to something very wonderful or very wondrous. Even though your energy may be low, yeah, okay. Finally, you arrive at hopelessness. This is probably the worst one. This is the bottom. But even though there is no more hope, again, there's no need to harm yourself. Despite your feelings as if there's no ground beneath you and no choice in any direction. The fact that you have no choice can be a good thing because you definitely know which way to go in the midst of this hopelessness. Actually, the last face to appear is the Buddha, right in the heart of hopelessness. We know that this is the path, and we resolve to stay with it. In Zen, there are no promises made, but we know that this is the practice too. This is how faith and vow are born within our practice. Needless to say, we develop faith through our own experience and physical and mental loss. It's proven over and over and over again. There's a story that is relevant when we find ourselves in this condition. One day, a monk was walking through the mountains near some cliffs when suddenly she fell. The ground slipped from beneath her feet. She experienced herself falling, and at that last moment, she was able to grab hold of some roots on the side of the cliff. Frightening, she called out, "Help! Help!" But no one around was able to hear her. After some time, a teacher, some students who were walking nearby, heard her cries and came to the edge of the cliff. When the monk saw them, she shouted, "Please, you've got to help me." The teacher looked at the situation and said to her, "You just have to let go. Isn't that wonderful? Just let go." The monk was terrified because she knew she was hanging vertically in midair, high above the ground. And yet, here's this teacher telling her to let go. "I can't," she cried. But the teacher was very firm and clear and told her, "You've got to let go. Without any hesitation, you've got to let go now." So she did. The monk let go and found that she had been hanging, that she had not been hanging vertically in midair after all. The entire time she had been lying horizontally. This is the confusion and distraction in our present day society, or in societies. And the ground had been supporting her all this time. We have so much confusion, so much delusion. Our egos have convinced us through our own thoughts that we are hanging vertically and that we're sure to fall straight down into the darkness. But when we do let go, how wonderful. We discover that the darkness is actually full of light. Now we can take a very deep rest, filled with the warmth of relief and complete satisfaction. When I was in Southwest recently, the vast landscapes were covered with snow. Although I felt a kind of cold desolation in this environment, I could still see a tip of early spring emerging from the snow. In southern Colorado, I was within the range of Sangre de Cristo, the Blood of Christ Mountains. The valley there is three times the size of Connecticut, and the mountains are 14,000 feet high and very sharp. My feeling was, these are the real mountains. Among them was a mountain called Greenhorn, which was rounder and softer than the others, yet it had a very impressive presence. The people I was with told me that this mountain had been under the ocean three times. Isn't that a very long time? The sharp and angular ones were the young mountains. And it's perfect that this is so. In the process of active participation in loss, we are worn down by space, by time. We are worn down by wind, rain, sun, moon, and stars. We are just like Greenhorn Mountain. But by actively participating in the wonder of real practice, we realize there is no choice. This realization is a very important one for you to make. Because you know this, you will stay on the path. In the truth, there was no other place to go. With the help of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you will go through and through, and you will realize what has always been here and what has always been with you. This active participation in loss is our great gift. I like to close with a poem I wrote. I don't write poetry often, but my hope is that I might share with you this precious gift of loss. Night dies into day. Day dies into night. Exhaling is intimate with loss. Inhaling, I'm renewed. Thank you.
Really what that means is your mind stream needs continuity of consciousness. That's what mind stream means. Purifying it refers to
thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.